Hello, angels, plural. I'm going to assume there's more than one of you. God, I hope there's more than one of you. It's Willow here. I am preparing to read you guys chapter 6 of F. Scott Fitzgerald's The Great Gatsby. If you have not heard chapters 1 through 5, they are pinned in the media channel of my Discord and also at the bottom of my audio index on Reddit. You should also be able to find them via my Soundgasm link as they are public. They're all, like, the titles are clear enough that you'll know what you're looking for. They range anywhere from, like, 25 minutes to 38 minutes, and it depends on the length of the chapter and how long it takes me to babble through all these pages. As such, this is a completely safe for work audio. If that's not your thing, that's totally fine. You don't have to listen. If you'd like something less safe for work, just scroll on up in that previously mentioned audio index and pick something up there, because there's a myriad of smut, different strokes for different folks, something for everybody, I'm pretty sure. For this context, my laptop sounds like it's trying to take off in front of me. For this context, this is a book that was written about the 1920s. As such, I'm going to tell you there is some thinly veiled sexism that is not very thinly veiled. There's also racism. The racism is not violent, but it is still hurtful. And if these are things that upset you, I don't blame you. They upset me as well. And you don't have to listen. I will not be offended if you'd like to step away. On that note, I don't know if there's any racism in this chapter. It's only been in a couple chapters. It's just been casual mentions, mostly out of Tom Buchanan's mouth. But it's been a little bit since I last read this book, so I don't really remember what happens on a chapter-by-chapter basis, so I don't know what's in chapter 6. We're all figuring it out together. Gosh, what else do I need to say to you? Get cozy, get comfy. I have some water because I'm going to be taking breaks to drink. This is a pretty, you know, casual audio. If you've listened to the other ones before, you know that I fuck up my words and I don't go back to fix them. We just stumble through it together. Also, if you can tell that I was crying before this audio, no you can't, and we're gonna get into it. This is a, I don't know if I've already told you, I've done a couple takes of this intro, so honestly I don't remember if I've told you how long this chapter is, but it's about 15 to 16 pages. So this might be a slightly shorter audio, as in probably won't go to 40 minutes, but God knows how long it's going to take me to get there. Okay, that was a rambly intro. Sad that the first take got fucked up, because it was a really seamless intro. But I think I've covered all the bases I need to cover for you. So, buckle up, get comfortable, and we are on to chapter 6 of F. Scott Fitzgerald's The Great Gatsby. About this time, an ambitious young reporter from New York arrived one morning at Gatsby's door and asked him if he had anything to say. "Anything to say about what?" inquired Gatsby politely. "Why, any statement to give out." It transpired after a few confused minutes that the man had heard Gatsby's name around his office in a connection which he either wouldn't reveal or didn't fully understand. This was his day off, and with laudable initiative, he had hurried out to see. It was a random shot, and yet the reporter's instinct was right. Gatsby's notoriety spread about by hundreds who had accepted his hospitality and so become authorities upon his past, had increased all summer until he fell just short of being news. Contemporary legends such as the Underground Pipeline to Canada attached themselves to him. And there was one persistent story that he didn't even live in the house at all, but in a boat that looked like a house and was moved secretly up and down the Long Island shore. Just why these inventions were a source of satisfaction to James Gatz of North Dakota wasn't easy. James Gatz was really, or at least legally, his name. He changed it at the age of 17, and at the specific moment that witnessed the beginning of his career. When he saw Dan Cody's yacht drop anchor over the most insidious flat on Lake Superior, it was James Gatz who had been loafing about on the beach that afternoon in a torn green jersey and a pair of canvas pants. But it was already Jay Gatsby, whose borrowed rowboat pulled out to the Tumalee and informed Cody that a wind might catch him and break him up in half an hour. I suppose he'd had the name ready for some long time even. His parents were shiftless and unsuccessful farm people. His imagination had never really accepted them as his parents at all. The truth was, Jay Gatsby of Westeg, Long Island, sprang from his platonic conception of himself. He was the son of God, a phrase which, if it means anything, means just that, and he dreamed about his father's business, the service of a vast, vulgar, and meticulous beauty. So he invented the sort of Jay Gatsby that a 17-year-old boy would likely invent, and to this conception he was faithful to the end. For over a year, he had been beating his way along the south shore of Lake Superior as a clam digger and a salmon fisher, or in any other capacity that brought him food and bed. His brown, hardening body lived naturally through the half-fierce, half-lazy work of the bracing days. He knew women early, and since they spoiled him, he became contemptuous of them, of young virgins because they were ignorant, of the others because they were hysterical about things in which his overwhelming self-absorption he took for granted. But his heart was a constant, turbulent riot. The most grotesque and fantastic conceits haunted him in his bed at night. A universal and ineffable gaudiness sprung itself out of his brain while the clock ticked on the... Why don't I have my glasses on? And where are they? Oh, sorry guys, I just realized I don't have my glasses on. I'm blind. Each night he added to the pattern of his fantasies until drowsiness closed down upon some vivid scene with an oblivious embrace. For a while, these reveries provided an outlet for his imagination. They were satisfactory, a hint of the unreality of his reality, a promise that the rock of the world was founded securely on a fairy's wing. An instinct towards his future glory had led him, some months before, to a small Lutheran college of St. Olaf in southern Minnesota. He stayed there 2 weeks, dismayed at its ferocious indifference to the drums of his destiny, to destiny itself, and despising the janitor's work, which he was to pay his way through. Then he drifted back to Lake Superior, and he was still searching for something to the day that Dan Cody's yacht dropped anchor in the shallows and longshore. Cody was 50 years old then, a product of the Nevada silver fields of the Yukon of every rush for metal since 75. The transactions in Montana copper that made him many times a millionaire found him physically robust but on the verge of soft-mindedness, and suspecting this, an infinite number of women who tried to separate him from his money. The none too savory ramifications by which Ella Kay, the newspaper woman, played Madame de Mention to his weaknesses and sent him to sea in a yacht were common knowledge. That turgid subjournalism of 1902. He had been coasting along all too hospitable shores for 5 years, and then he turned up as James Gatz's destiny in Little Girl Bay. To young Gatz, resting in his oars and looking up at the railed deck, that yacht represented all the beauty and glamour in the world. I suppose he smiled at Cody. He had probably discovered that people liked him when he smiled. At any rate, Cody asked him a few questions, one of them elicited the brand new name, and found out he was a quick and extravagantly ambitious. A few days later, he took him to Duluth and bought him a blue coat, 6 pairs of white duck trousers, and a yachting cap. Then, the Tumalee left for the West Indies and the Barbary Coast, Gatsby left too. He was employed in a vague personal capacity. While he remained with Cody, he was a intern steward, mate, skipper, secretary, and even jailer for Dan Cody sober when he was for Dan Cody sober knew what lavish doings Dan Cody drunk might soon be about, and he provided for such contingencies by reposing more and more trust in Gatsby. The arrangement lasted for 5 years, during which the boat went 3 times around the continent. It might have lasted indefinitely, except for the fact that Ella Kay came on board one night in Boston, and a week later Dan Cody inhospitably died. I remember the portrait of him up in Gatsby's bedroom, a gray, florid man with a hard, empty face. The pioneer Dubache, who, during one phase of American life, brought back the eastern seaboard, the savage violence of the frontier brothel and saloon. It was indirectly due to Cody that Gatsby drank so little. Sometimes, in the course of gay parties, women used to rub champagne into his hair. For himself, he formed the habit of letting liquor alone. And it was from Cody that he inherited money. a legacy of $25,000. He didn't get it. He never understood the legal device that was used against him, but what remained of the millions went intact to Ella Kay. He was left with his singularly appropriate education, the vague contour of Jay Gatsby had filled into the substantiality of a man. He told me all of this much later, but I've put down here with the idea of exploding those first wild rumors about his anecdotes, which weren't even faintly true. Moreover, he told it to me at a time of confusion, when I had reached out to the point of believing everything and nothing about him. So I take advantage of his short halt while Gatsby, so to speak, caught his breath to clear this set of misconceptions away. It was a halt, too, in my associations with his affairs. For several weeks, I didn't see him or hear his voice on the phone. Mostly, I was in New York, trotting around with Jordan and trying to integrate myself with her senile aunt. But finally, I went over to his house on one Sunday afternoon. I hadn't been there 2 minutes when somebody brought Tom Buchanan in for a drink. I was startled, naturally, but the really surprising thing was that it hadn't happened before. They were a party of three on horseback, Tom and a man named Salone and a pretty woman in brown riding habit who seemed to have been there previously. "I'm delighted to see you," said Gatsby, standing on his porch. "I'm delighted that you dropped in," as though they cared. "Sit right down. Have a cigarette or a cigar." He walked around the room quickly, ringing bells. "I'll have something to drink for you in just a minute." He was profoundly affected by the fact that that Tom was there, but he would be uneasy anyhow until he had given them something, realizing in a vague way that they had all come for, what they had all come for. Mr. Salone wanted nothing. "A lemonade? No, thanks. A little champagne? Nothing at all, thanks. I'm sorry. Did you have a nice ride? Very good roads around here. I suppose the automobiles..." "Yeah." Moved by an irresistible impulse, Gatsby turned to Tom, who had accepted the introduction as a stranger. "I believe we've met somewhere before, Mr. Buchanan." "Oh, yes," said Tom, gruffly polite, but obviously not remembering. "So we did. I remember it really well." "About 2 weeks ago?" "That's right. You were with Nick here." "I know your wife," continued Gatsby, almost aggressively. "That's so?" Tom turned to me. "You live here, Nick?" "Next door." "That's so." Mr. Salone didn't enter the conversation, but lounged back haughtily in his chair, and the woman said nothing either, until unexpectedly, after two highballs, she became cordial. We'll all come over to your next party, Mr. Gatsby," she suggested. "What do you say?" "Certainly, I'd be delighted to have you." "Be very nice," said Mr. Salone without gratitude. "Well, I think we ought to start hurrying home." "Please don't hurry," Gatsby urged them. He had to control himself now, and he wanted to see more of Tom. Why don't you stay for supper? I wouldn't be surprised if some other people dropped in from New York." "You come to supper with me," the lady said casually. "Both of you." "That included me." Mr. Salone got to his feet. "Come along," he said, but to her only. "I mean it," she insisted. "I'd love to have you. Lots of room." Gatsby looked at me questioningly. He wanted to go, and he didn't see that Mr. Salone had determined he shouldn't. "I'm afraid I won't be able to," I said. "Well, you come," she urged, concentrating on Gatsby. Mr. Salone murmured something close to her ear. "We won't be late if we start now," she insisted aloud. "I haven't got a horse," said Gatsby. "I used to ride in the army, but I never bought a horse. I'll have to follow you in my car. Excuse me for just a minute." The rest of us walked out to the porch, where Salone and the lady began an impassioned conversation aside. "My God, I believe the man's coming," said Tom. "Doesn't he know that she doesn't want him?" "She says she does want him. She has a big dinner party, and he won't know a soul there," he frowned. "I wonder where in the devil he met Daisy. By God, I may be old-fashioned in my ideas, but women run around too much these days to suit me. They meet all kinds of crazy fish." Suddenly, Mr. Salone and the lady walked down the steps and mounted their horses. "Come on," said Mr. Salone to Tom. "We're late. We've got to go." And then to me, "Tell him we couldn't wait, will you?" Tom and I shook hands, and the rest of us exchanged a cool nod, and they trotted quickly down the drive, disappearing under the August foliage just as Gatsby, with a hat and a light overcoat in his hand, came out the front door. Tom was evidently perturbed at Daisy's running around alone, for on the following Saturday night, he came with her to Gatsby's party. Perhaps his presence gave the evening its peculiar quality of oppressiveness. It stands out in my memory from Gatsby's other parties that summer. There was the same people, or at least same sort of people, the same profusion of champagne and the same many-colored, many-keyed commotion, but I felt an unpleasantness in the air, a pervading harshness that hadn't been there before. Or perhaps I'd merely grown used to it, grown to accept West Egg as a world complete in itself, with its own standards and its own great figures, second to nothing because it had no consciousness of being so. And now I was looking at it again, through Daisy's eyes. That was a long sentence. There were so many commas in that sentence. It's like a collective sentence I write. Jesus. It is invariably saddening to look through new eyes upon things which you have expended your own powers of adjustment. They arrived at twilight, and as we strolled out among the sparkling hundreds, Daisy's voice was playing murmurous tricks in her throat. "These things excite me so," she whispered. "If you just want to kiss me at any time during the evening, Nick, just let me know and I'll be glad to arrange it for you. Just mention my name, or present a green card. I'm giving out green..." "Look around," suggested Gatsby. "I'm looking around. I'm having a marvelous..." "You must see the faces of many people you've heard about." Tom's arrogant eyes roamed the crowd. "We don't go around very much," he said. "In fact, I was just thinking, I don't know a soul here." "Perhaps you know that lady," Gatsby indicated, a gorgeous, scarcely human orchid of a woman who sat in a state under a white plum tree. Tom and Daisy stared at her with that peculiar, unreal feeling that accompanies the recognition of Hiterto, ghostly celebrity of the movies. "She's lovely," said Daisy. "The man bending over is her director." He took them both ceremoniously from group to group, Mrs. Buchanan and Mr. Buchanan. After an instant's hesitation, he added, "The polo player." "Oh, no," objected Tom quickly. "Not me." But evidently the sound of it pleased Gatsby, for Tom remained the polo player for the rest of the evening. "I've never met so many celebrities," Daisy exclaimed. "I like that man. What was his name? With the sort of blue nose?" Gatsby identified him, adding that he was a small producer. "Well, I liked him anyhow." "I'd rather not be the polo player," said Tom pleasantly. "I'd rather look at all these famous people in oblivion." Daisy and Gatsby danced. I remember being surprised by his graceful, conservative foxtrot. I'd never seen him dance before. Then they sauntered over to my house and sat on the steps for half an hour, while at her request I remained watchfully in the garden, in case there's a fire or a flood, she explained, or any act of God. Tom appeared from his oblivion as we were sitting down to supper together. "Do you mind if I eat with some of those people over here?" he said. "A fellow's getting off some funny stuff." "Go ahead," answered Daisy. "And if you want to take down any addresses, here's my little gold pencil." She looked around after a moment and told me the girl was common but pretty. And I knew that, except for the half hour she'd been alone with Gatsby, she wasn't having a good time. I'm going to take a quick drink. Do the same. If you're not hydrated, you should be. Hydrate for me. You deserve it. If your pee is not clear or not drinking enough water. Is this what you signed up for? No. Willow shows her tits on the internet, but she's also an asshole about hydration. Okay. We were at a particularly tipsy table. That was my fault. Gatsby had been called on the phone, and I had enjoyed these same people only 2 weeks before. But what had amused me then turned septic in the air now. "How do you feel, miss?" The girl addressed was trying unsuccessfully to slump against my shoulder. At this inquiry, she sat up and opened her eyes. A massive and lethargic woman who had been urging Daisy to play golf with her at a local club tomorrow spoke in her defense. "Oh, she's all right now. She's had 5 or 6 cocktails. She's always screaming like that. I tell her she ought to leave it alone." "I do leave it alone," affirmed the accused hollowly. "We heard you yelling. So I said to Doc Civet here, there's somebody who needs your help, Doc." "She's much obliged, I'm sure," said another friend without gratitude. "But you got her dress all wet when you stuck her head in the pool." "Anything I hate is to get my head stuck in a pool," she muttered. "They almost drowned me once over in New Jersey." They ought to leave you alone, countered the doctor. Speak for yourself. Then you ought to leave it alone. I was like, what does that mean? Then you ought to leave it alone, countered the doctor. Speak for yourself, she cried violently. Your hand shakes. That's why I wouldn't let you operate on me. It was like that. Almost the last thing I remember was standing with Daisy and watching a movie picture director and his star. They were all still under the white plum tree, and their faces were touching except for a pale, thin ray of moonlight between them. It occurred to me that he had been very slowly bending towards her all evening to attain this proximity, and even while I watched him stoop one ultimate degree to kiss her cheek. I like her, said Daisy. I think she's lovely. But the rest offended her. She had an arguably, because it wasn't the gesture, but emotion. She was appalled by West Egg, this unprecedented place that Broadway had begotten on Long Island Fishing Village, appalled by its raw vigor that chafed under the old euphemisms, and by the too obtrusive fate that herded the inhabitants along the shortcut from nothing to nothing. She saw something awful in the very simplicity she failed to understand. I sat on the front steps with them while they waited for their car. It was dark here in the front. The only bright door sent 10 square feet of light volleying out into the soft black morning. Sometimes a shadow moved against it in a dressing room blind above, gave way to another shadow, an indefinite procession of shadows that rouged and powdered in all invisible glass. "Who's that Gatsby, anyhow?" demanded Tom suddenly. "Some big bootlegger?" "Where'd you hear that?" I inquired. "I didn't hear it. I imagined it. A lot of these newly rich people are just big bootleggers, you know." "Not Gatsby," I said shortly. He was silent for a moment. The pebbles of the drive crunched under his feet. Well, he certainly must have strained himself to get this menagerie together. A breeze stirred the gray haze of Daisy's fur collar. "At least there's more interesting people than we ever know." "At least there's more interesting people than the people we know," she said with an effort. "You didn't look so interested." "Well, I was." Tom laughed and turned to me. "Did you notice Daisy's face when that girl asked her how to put her under a cold shower?" Daisy began to sing with the music in a husky, rhythmic whisper, bringing out a meaning in each word that had never been heard before and would never have again. When the melody rose, her voice broke up sweetly, following it in a way that contralto voices have, and each change tipped out a little bit of her warm human magic upon the air. "Lots of people who come who haven't been invited," she said suddenly. "That girl hadn't been invited. They simply forced their way in, and he's too polite to object." "I like to think who he is and what he does," insisted Tom. "Oh, I'd like to know who he is and what he does," insisted Tom. "I think I'll make a point of finding out." "I can tell you right now," she answered. "He owns some drugstores, lots of drugstores. He built them up himself." The dilatory limousine came rolling up the drive. "Good night, Nick," said Daisy. Her glance left me and sought the lighted up at the top of the steps, where 3 o'clock in the morning, a neat, sad little waltz of the year was drifting through the open door. After all, in the very casualness of Gatsby's parties, there was a romantic possibility totally absent from the other world. What was it up there in the song that seemed to be calling her back inside? What would happen now in the dim, incalculable hours? Perhaps some unbelievable guest would arrive, a person infinitely rare and to be marveled at. Some authentically radiant young girl who, with one fresh face glance at Gatsby, one moment of magical encounter, would blot out those 5 years of unwavering devotion. I stayed late that night. Gatsby asked me to wait until he was free, and I lingered in the garden until the inevitable swimming party had run up, chilled and exalted, from the black beach until the lights were extinguished in the guest rooms overhead. When he came down to the steps last, that tan skin was drawn unusually tight on his face, and his eyes were bright and tired. "She didn't like it," he said immediately. "Of course she did." "She didn't like it," he insisted. "She didn't have a good time." I was silent, and I guessed at his unutterable depression. "I feel far away from her. It's hard to make her understand." "You mean about the dance?" "The dance?" He dismissed all sorts of dances he had given with a snap of his fingers. old sport that dance is unimportant. He wanted nothing less of Daisy than she should go to Tom and say, I never loved you. After she had obliterated 4 years with that sentence, they could decide upon the more practical measures to be taken. One of them that was, after she was free, they were to go back to Louisville and be married from her house, just as if it were 5 years ago. She doesn't understand, he said. She used to be able to understand. We'd sit for hours. He broke off again and began to walk up and down a desolate path of fruit rinds and discarded favors and crushed flowers. I wouldn't ask too much of her, I ventured. You can't repeat the past. Can't repeat the past? He cried incredulously. Why, of course you can. He looked around him wildly, as if the past were lurking here in the shadow of his house, just out of reach of his hand. I'm going to fix everything the way it was before, he said, nodding determinedly. She'll see. He talked a lot about the past, and I gathered that he wanted to recover something. Some idea of himself, perhaps, that had gone into loving Daisy. His life had been confused and disordered since then, but if he could once return to a certain starting place and go over it all slowly, he could find out what that thing was. One autumn night, 5 years before, they had been walking down the street when leaves were falling, and they came to a place where there were no trees and the sidewalk was white with moonlight. They stopped here, turned towards each other. Now it was a cool night, with that mysterious excitement in which comes along at the two changes of the year. The quiet lights in the houses were humming into darkness, and there was a stir and bustle amongst the stars. Out of the corner of his eye, Gatsby saw that the blocks of sidewalks really formed a ladder and mounted to a secret place above the trees. He could climb to it, if he climbed alone, and once he was there, suck out the pap of life, gulp down the incomparable milk of wonder. His heart beat faster and faster as Daisy's white face came up to his own. He knew that when he kissed this girl, and forever wed this unutterable visions to her perishable breath, his mind would never romp again like the mind of God. So he waited, listening for a moment longer to that tuning fork that had been struck upon a star. Then he kissed her. At his lips' touch, she blossomed for him like a flower, and the incarnation was complete. Even though his appalling sentimentality, I was reminded of something, an elusive rhythm, a fragment of lost words that I had heard somewhere a long time ago. For a moment, the phrase tried to take shape in my mouth, and my lips parted like a dumb man's, as though there was more struggling upon them than a wisp of startled air. But they made no sound, and what I had almost remembered was uncommunicable forever. This was not the longest chapter, but good God Almighty, is it the one that matters. Thank you for hanging out with me. I love doing this, so your presence is great. I hope you enjoyed this, and I'll see you tomorrow for Chapter 7. As always, have a great night, angels.